Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yawkey reporting. UN Security Council to discuss North Korea rocket launch. The United Nations Security Council is holding an emergency meeting today to discuss North Korea's launch of a long-range rocket. The rocket, which carried what Pyongyang said was a satellite, was launched today from North Korea's Tongchang-ri satellite launching facility near the northwestern border with China. It immediately drew criticism from around the world. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said it was deeply deplorable. Similar statements were issued by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. South Korea and Japan also denounced the launch. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said his country will not tolerate the rocket launch after repeated warnings from the international community not to do so. Abe said it is a clear violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Thousands of rescue workers in Taiwan are clawing through vast amounts of wreckage, searching for survivors of a powerful earthquake that ravaged the city of Tainan on the island's southwest coast. Authorities said Saturday's pre-dawn 6.4 magnitude quake killed at least 24 people and injured more than 500 others in Tainan. Most of the victims were in a 17-story apartment building that collapsed. Officials say they will investigate whether there were any building code construction violations. Two other partially collapsed buildings were left tilting sharply away from their foundations, with their lower floors crumpled under tons of concrete and steel. At least 250 people are believed to have been inside their apartments at the time of the earthquake, and authorities said today that more than 120 of those residents are thought to be still trapped. This is VOA News. Somali government officials say airport security cameras caught two people dressed in military uniforms passing a laptop to the passenger who died after Tuesday's mid-flight bomb blast aboard a passenger plane. Cabinet spokesman Abdi Salan Ahmed Otto told VOA the National Intelligence Agency has security recordings showing two men giving a laptop in a hidden way to a passenger. European Union officials are urging Turkey to open a border crossing where tens of thousands of Syrian civilians have arrived, fleeing a massive government offensive in Aleppo province. EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini said EU support for Turkey is aimed at guaranteeing Turkey can handle the influx of refugees.
It is unquestionable the fact that people coming from inside Syria are Syrians in need for international protection.
The Turkish prime minister said Ankara would allow the refugees into the country, but so far has not opened a key border crossing with Syria. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos says more than 3,100 pregnant women in his country are infected with the mosquito-borne Zika virus. But Santos, speaking Saturday on national television, said there is no evidence yet definitively linking the virus to the devastating fetal development disorder known as microcephaly, which leaves newborns with deformed skulls and underdeveloped brains. There is no vaccine or treatment for the virus, and scientists have not yet established a direct link between Zika and a spike in birth deformities reported in neighboring Brazil. In U.S. politics, Republican presidential candidates faced off at a debate in New Hampshire late Saturday. It came just 3 days before the state's presidential primary, a crucial election that could make or end several of the candidates' presidential bids. Businessman Donald Trump is the front-runner in pre-election polls. He spoke with reporters after the debate.
It's easier to poll New Hampshire because you don't have the caucus system. The caucus system is very complex and very tricky, and you saw that, you know, by what happened to Ben. But I think we're going to do really well here. And, you know, I've had a relationship with New Hampshire for many, many years. Many, many years, and have so many friends up here beyond the political stuff. So I think I'm going to do well, and it was very important that I, you know, do a good job at the debate.
On the Democratic Party side of the New Hampshire primary, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has a significant lead over former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton going into Tuesday's vote. The spectacle of the U.S. National Football League's annual championship game extends far beyond the stadium in California, where the Super Bowl is being played tonight. Super Bowl Sunday is as close as it gets to a national holiday in the United States that is not actually a holiday. People across the country gather with friends and family at house parties and bars to watch the game, making for historic television ratings. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote has the day off.
The UN should accept these weapons and enroll these people on the scheme, as Odanga tells the UA.
The UN tries a new approach in the disarmament, demobilization, and the reintegration of armed groups in the Central African Republic.
Since towards the end of last year and the start of this year, totally we don't have any business. We are spending most of the time standing, not serving any client.
Nairobi taxi drivers protest the American app-based taxi service Uber, which they say is undercutting fares and causing them to lose business.
I had no idea what the farm was to be or to become. I knew that I was not prepared to use artificial fertilizers or poisons.
And in South Africa, many small farmers abandon the use of expensive chemicals to aid their food production. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Saturday was the International Day of Zero Tolerance to Female Genital Mutilation, and a group in Sierra Leone held an event to raise more awareness on the dangers of the practice. Nina DeVries has more from the capital of Freetown.
As a child, Anne-Marie Kalkner was forced to undergo female genital mutilation, or FGM, which some people refer to as female circumcision. The traditional practice removes some or all parts of the external female genitalia. It's seen by some as a rite of passage for girls and a way to make a girl more appealing to a husband. Kalkner says the violation was so severe it prompted her to form her own non-governmental organization called the National Movement for Emancipation and Progress, or NAMEP. The NGO works with local communities to educate them about the dangerous effects of FGM, such as health complications. On Saturday, local leaders and residents of a community in the western part of Freetown were there to listen. Chief Pa Fode Conte has been to several of NAMEP's discussions. He says although FGM is a traditional practice, he understands how harmful it can be to girls. He's now talking more to men about it. He says changing an entire mindset will take time.
Some will say yes, some will say no, you see. But as time goes, I believe all of them will know, say yes, this is a good idea for us.
Kalkner agrees.
But we will not give up because to any battle, there must be a challenge. There must be confrontation.
The Sowies are the women who perform the cutting, and many see it as a business. Chief Kadiatu Ansu Khan is a Sowie. She understands the concerns of NAMEP, but financial challenges remain.
Today we get our own livelihood for manage yourself your own life.
Speaking in her native Creole dialect, she says many people depend on the practice of FGM for their livelihood and that it's helped them earn a good income. NAMEP works with Sowies to help them learn other life skills such as tailoring. And international NGOs like the United Nations Children Fund are also working to end FGM along with the local government. Sandra Latouf is UNICEF's deputy representative in Sierra Leone. She says that during the Ebola crisis, the government banned the tradition due to the issue of touching. The virus is transmitted through direct contact with bodily fluids. This led to a decrease in the practice.
For the time being, the ban shows some fact, and the fact is that we can change behavior. And this is where we want really to work with the community, with the SOA, with all the leaders.
She adds that ending FGM is included in the Sustainable Development Goals created by the United Nations to make progress in such areas as climate change and gender equality. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The United Nations is trying a new approach to the disarmament, demobilization, and the reintegration or DDR of armed groups. The new approach, described as pre-DDR, is being launched in the Central African Republic's northern town of Kaga Bandoro, where former combatants of the mainly Muslim Saleka armed group and the Christian and animist anti-Balaka movement are being paid to do community work. For VOA, Nick Long sent this report from Kaga Bandoro.
Since November, the UN mission in Kagabandoro has enrolled 481 ex-combatants in pre-DDR and is paying most of them nearly $4 a day, mainly for cleaning up the town. To qualify, they had to hand in weapons, 206 locally made hunting rifles, 10 modern assault rifles, and 2,600 rounds of ammunition. Pre-DDR is a temporary arrangement pending the launch of a full-scale disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate program, which will have to be planned by the government. Unlike a conventional DDR program, this deal does not involve giving each ex-combatant training for a particular occupation. But some of those in the program in Kagabandoro have already saved enough money to launch their own businesses, including shops and even an internet cafe. On Friday, the mission collected more arms from about 130 people. But UN weapons expert Helder Gaspar da Costa was not impressed with the haul.
Combien tu as payé pour ça?
15,000.
15,000? Travail cher, hein?
Da Costa asks one young man who's presented a locally made hunting rifle how much he paid for it. The man says he paid 15,000 Central African francs, about $25. Da Costa says that was expensive and questions whether there's any ammunition. When the young man says that there's none, Da Costa says the gun is useless and probably a fake. About half of the dozens of hunting rifles handed in are listed as non-operational. Da Costa also questioned people as to whether they were real combatants. You are living in Boto and fighting on the Dago axis, he asks another man, claiming to be anti-Balaka. That's 48 kilometers. Then you are doing a marathon every day. Get real, he says. Da Costa says former combatants must bring in real weapons or they will not be accepted for pre-DDR. He challenges anti-Balaka supervisor Maxim Azudanga to produce genuine ex-combatants. Azudanga wanted the UN to accept the applicants who assembled on Friday. The UN should accept these weapons and enroll these people on the scheme, Azudanga tells VOA. Otherwise, they'll go back to banditry, he says. The United Nations is considering benefits for communities that hand in this type of weapon, Da Costa says. Benefits like solar panels for community use are being considered, but not pre-DDR payments for individuals. Nick Long for VOA News, Kagabandoro, Central African Republic.
A new UNESCO publication says thousands of African children lack textbooks or must share them. Educationalists say that along with skilled teachers, textbooks are essential for meeting the unbacked sustainable development goals which call for inclusive and equitable quality education for all. From Washington, VOA's William Eagle reports.
The Global Educational Monitoring Report policy paper published by UNESCO discusses the extent of the shortages and proposes solutions. It says that in Cameroon, one study showed there were 12 students for one reading book and 14 to a math book. In some parts of Uganda, there were up to 30 pupils per textbook. Asma Zuberi, a researcher for the report, says shortages can be particularly acute according to primary grade level and location of the school.
Provision of books in the earlier grades, which in some cases should be paramount, because this is where the largest impact on learning can take place, is where many children are actually without access to textbooks.
The World Bank recommends between 3 to 5% of a country's education budget be spent on textbooks. But the report found that in reality, a very small amount is earmarked for such purchases. In fact, UNESCO says that in some countries like Burundi and the Central African Republic, that figure is only 1%. Other problems contribute to the shortages. Money promised to schools for books and materials in the approved budget may arrive late or be diverted for other uses. Some African officials try to save money by purchasing books with poor quality paper and binding.
In Ethiopia, this is a very good example where secondary school textbooks were being printed on poor quality paper and with poor binding, although they were being produced quite cheaply. But what this inevitably meant is that textbooks were having to be replaced much more frequently. And this coupled with the fact that there was quite poor distribution and storage meant that many children were being left without books.
Remedies for the shortages include increasing share of education budgets spent on textbooks and also improving transparency. Zuberi says Africa could make use of a model created in the Philippines, where at one point 40% of book deliveries were not accounted for. The problem was solved with improved monitoring and transparency, thanks to the cooperation between civil society groups and the Ministry of Education. The UNESCO report also says funding can be made more available and costs could be contained, with improved forecasting for the number of books needed over a multi-year period. She says it's a model used successfully by the International Vaccine Alliance called Gavi.
As the health sector has demonstrated through the use of demand forecasting for vaccines, what you found there is that not only does it lead to more predictable funding, but it also reduces quite a lot of the wastage, which is something that the textbook sector should try and emulate.
UNESCO hopes the plan will help attract and allocate funding and resources similar to the model used for ensuring the international availability of vaccines. Officials say if the model works as well in the education sector as it does in the health sector, the plan could attract sustainable funding over a multi-year period and encourage private investors to take part in the book market. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
More than 700 journalists and others who report the news have been killed over the past decade. That's according to data collected by the UN cultural organization UNESCO. The agency brought together journalists, broadcasters, and media executives from across the world at a symposium on Friday in Paris to advocate for greater safety in their profession. For Marius Loconcianias, a program specialist in UNESCO's communication and information sector, the killing of a journalist is an ultimatum form of censorship. UN Radio's Diane Payne asked him about the prospective outcomes of the conference.
What is important here is that for the first time UNESCO is involving high-level decision makers, because we think that that group is extremely important in strengthening safety of journalists and, of course, fighting against impunity.
Are we seeing a rise in attacks on journalists and other people who work in the media?
You know, more than 700 were killed in the last decade, but I have to say that this is not only about the numbers which are going up. It is also about the fact that these killings of journalists are spreading across the board. 10 years ago, for example, the largest amount of journalists killed were, of course, journalists who were working in the hotspots, in the post-war or war situations. Now, it's more and more also local journalists, journalists who are doing investigative reporting. We're also seeing that this plague, so to say, is reaching more and more into the areas of the profession where it was not featuring itself that clearly before.
Could you explain that further, the areas of the profession where we didn't see it?
I mean local journalists. I mean regional press. I mean journalists who are sometimes also acting as bloggers. The internet technology, of course, makes more and more people being able to speak out against corruption.
Now, you referred to this killing of journalists, whether they are professional journalists or citizen journalists, bloggers. You referred to it as a plague. Tell us, what impact is this plague having on freedom of expression?
It has a very direct impact. All of us, we understand that killing a journalist is an ultimate form of censorship. And, of course, freedom of expression and press freedom is something which is completely opposite to censorship. It also leads to self-censorship. It also denies people of information. So all these elements, they do work against freedom of expression and against press freedom, and these are the ultimate human rights.
What outcome are you expecting from the symposium?
As I've mentioned, this is the first gathering of high-level media leaders. So first, what we are expecting is that we are building up a momentum. There will be a lot of brainstorming on innovative solutions. We have a lot of ICT applications and other different kind of IT and not only IT-based solutions which strengthen safety of journalists.
That was Marius Loukosianis, communication and information specialist at UNESCO. He spoke with UN Radio's Adrian Penn. Nairobi taxi drivers are angry at the American app-based taxi service Uber, which they say is undercutting fares and causing them to lose business. Recent attacks on Uber drivers and threats of road closing protests are heightening tensions in the Kenyan capital. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Taxi drivers in Nairobi have become more and more frustrated with Uber, the app-based taxi service that came to this city in January 2015. On Wednesday, taxi operators asked Kenya's government to stop Uber, a service which has risen in popularity here due to its cheaper fares. Frederick Chalo is one of those taxi drivers who says that Uber is responsible for his declining business.
Since towards the end of last year and the start of this year, totally we don't have any business. We are spending most of the time standing, not serving any client.
Chalo and many of his colleagues argue that they just want a fair playing field, and Uber's cheaper pricing model serves to undercut them.
It's not that I don't like them being in Nairobi, because competition is allowed everywhere, but the problem is the way they entered into this business. You know, when you enter the business, you have to adhere to their tariff, but their tariff is quite different from all other stakeholders in Kenya.
Other taxi drivers, like Peter Karanja, say it's not Uber's pricing model that bothers him the most. It's the fees he insists they are not paying.
We like fair competition. What they're doing is not fair, actually, because we do not think that they're paying taxes as we are doing.
Karanja is referring to the charges he has to pay to stay in business legally. This includes a police inspection sticker costing about $88 per year, a public service vehicle driver's license at about $30 per year, and insurance, which is calculated at 5.5% of his vehicle's value. But Taha Muhammad Ali, who owns several cars that are used for Uber, says Uber drivers must pay these same fees. If Uber drivers are found to not be in compliance, he says, they are automatically deactivated in the system when their documents expire. Muhammad Ali adds that taxi drivers in Nairobi have attacked four of his Uber drivers over the past 20 days.
They just see Uber as this big evil thing out there which is taking over. But it's not. It's actually enabling. It's enabling all these people, because the amount of people using taxis has just gone up so high after Uber entered here. Because normally, you know, people have like one taxi driver or two taxi drivers who they've used. And if those two guys are busy, they just won't use a taxi. But now, you just know that you only go to just open Uber app and just call any Uber, and you know that it's safe and it's cheap and you don't have to think about bargaining and everything is tracked and it's just perfect.
In a written statement, Uber said, "Our technology is open and pro-choice, and we are keen to offer it to a broad number of taxi drivers to boost their occupancy rates and chances for profit." So far, taxi drivers are not mollified. On Wednesday, the drivers issued a 7-day ultimatum to the government to kick Uber out of Nairobi. Failure to do so, they say, will lead to them protesting and paralyzing traffic. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Many small farmers in South Africa are abandoning the use of expensive chemicals to aid their food production. They are trying to capture a growing consumer market that wants ethically produced, healthy food. It's not a new kind of farming. Some South Africans have been doing it for years. In this second part of our series on people producing high-quality food in South Africa, Darren Taylor reports for VOA on one of the pioneers of organic farming.
Elizabeth Ames says as soon as she saw this land in the Hekpoort Valley in South Africa's northwest province more than 50 years ago, she knew she had her farm. The terrain is rugged and rocky, just like the 80-year-old herself, with her tough, mottled skin and no-nonsense approach.
I had no idea what the farm was to be or to become. I knew that I was not prepared to use artificial fertilizers or poisons.
Ames studied agriculture at college and started Weleda Dairy Farm in the 1960s, at a time when women in formal agriculture were rare worldwide. She's always been dedicated to producing fine dairy products naturally. She doesn't give her Jersey cows any growth stimulants or antibiotics and never sprays her land with pesticides. The farmer's animals are free range, grazing on natural high-felt grass all day, sheltered in spacious barns at night. Ames pours milk into a container to make cream. Her farm produces a variety of products, from milk to cheese to yogurt, containing no preservatives.
And there is nothing in these things that anybody would be allergic to other than lactose.
An electronic system of suction valves removes milk from cows' udders and deposits it in large transparent tanks. Ames says her cows produce small amounts of milk because she doesn't do anything artificial to them, as she puts it.
Cows can have things implanted in their ears, hormones, which will increase the production. And that means that on the same amount of food, they will give you far more milk. That means it is economically more viable.
But, says Ames, she's into the ethical production of high-quality dairy, not into farming to get rich. She says she loves her cows and calls them her children. She's named every one of them.
Well, May has just calved a little girl, and her name is June. And Sun had Moon, and now they've had a daughter. One of them has calved, and she will be Venus. Well, they're just my family. They're just my family.
Ames says she mourned a long time a few years ago when stock thieves stole one of her animals and butchered it in a neighbouring settlement. Weleda farm workers monitor big silver pumps channeling milk inside a shed. Ames has a strong relationship with her employees. She's built houses for them. She almost adopted one, a Mozambican, as her son, after authorities threatened to deport him. But Ames is a tough taskmaster.
I do expect them to be punctual. And if they aren't, they lose money. One of them came to complain to me that last week he had lost 50 rand. And I said, yes, that's because you were late. And I said, and today it's 20 past six. You were not here at six. The cow should be here at six. So you're going to lose it again.
The way Ames runs her farm and treats her animals results in excellent dairy products. One of her biggest fans is the manager of Fresh Earth Organic Food Store in Johannesburg. Andre Brown sells Weleda Farm's butter, cheese and yogurt.
We've been stocking Elizabeth's stuff there from Belida for quite some time, and there's a reason why we'll keep on stocking her stuff. As Elizabeth is quite scrupulous if it comes to her product. She's a very proud woman. She's a very nice Buritani. She doesn't deviate from her philosophy about what she's doing with her product.
Successful though Ames is, it's never easy for her on the farm. She's survived a few attacks on her by criminals. Once, three men broke into her house at night and threw her out of bed, demanding money.
One of them sat on me, bruised my ribs, and hurt the upper skin of my right hand.
What are all these stains on the carpet? Is that from your blood?
Yes, from blood. Handy Andy is the best for removing blood.
On another occasion, armed robbers shot into her bedroom while she was asleep. Sunlight dapples onto her bed through several holes in her curtains. Her wall is pockmarked.
I wasn't even so much afraid of the shots, but the breaking glass was very noisy. You can see up top where they hit. That was the third one. The fourth one would have hit me in bed, but I managed to get out of bed and into the bathroom where I could find my shorts.
So these are bullet holes?
Those are bullet holes, yes.
A thunderstorm unleashes welcome rain on Ames's parched land. She has plenty of reasons to give up farming, from violence against her to looming drought to financial struggles. But Ames says she's never considered quitting.
The reason why I do it is because I'm a farmer. There's nothing else I can do. I mean, I have, every now and then, I've got to do things like write invoices. I have planted every tree. I have put in every fence.
This love, she says, is more powerful than any fear inside her. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in the Hekpoort Valley, South Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, the latest in sports, music from African collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, in Nightline Africa Sports, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has voted to back Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa of Bahrain for FIFA president. However, the 54 African federations will vote separately in the election to decide Sepp Blatter's successor in Zurich on February 26th. But FIFA's new member, South Sudan, has decided to back the other leading contender, Gianni Infantino, for the FIFA presidency. That's according to South Sudan's football chief, Chabul Gauch Alai. Infantino, who is the general secretary of UEFA, became the Confederation's candidate when President Michel Platini was prevented from taking part over the payment scandal that saw him banned from football for 8 years. In addition to Sheikh Salman, Infantino is standing against South Africa's businessman Tokyo Saxwale, former FIFA Assistant Secretary General Jerome Champagne, and Jordan's FIFA Executive Committee member Prince Al Bin Al Hussein. Africa is the continent with most votes. Europe has 53, Asia 46, CONCACAF, that's North Central America and Caribbean, has 35, Oceania 11, and the Infantino supporting CONMEBOL or South America has 10. Meanwhile, the African Nations Championship crown will be decided later Sunday in Kigali, Rwanda, as the DR Congo inaugural winners from 2009 attempt to add the second title against unlikely opposition Mali. It's a climax to the three-week-long tournament organized by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, and reserved for home-based footballers who play in their own national leagues. Earlier Sunday, Ivory Coast beat Guinea 2-1 to take third place in an entertaining match at Kigali's Amahoro Stadium. And here in the U.S., the U.S. National Football League Super Bowl 50 Championship game on Sunday between the Denver Broncos and Carolina Panthers will feature quarterbacks who are separated in age by 13 years. And as VOA's Park Brewer reports in this preview from San Francisco, their playing styles are as contrasting as their ages.
Denver quarterback Peyton Manning will be 40 next month, well past the playing age of most NFL quarterbacks. Carolina quarterback Cam Newton is 26, playing his fifth year in the league compared to 17 seasons for Manning. Newton is considered one of the best and most electrifying players in the NFL, and he is also one of the fastest and biggest quarterbacks, standing nearly 2 meters tall and weighing 111 kilograms. He led the NFL this season with 45 total touchdowns, 35 passing, and 10 rushing. And he nearly led Carolina to an undefeated season with just one late-season loss. Manning knows Denver faces a difficult task trying to contain Newton in Super Bowl 50.
He's been a great passer. He's been a great runner. He's been a great leader. You don't go 17-1 as a starting quarterback without being awesome. That's what he's been this year, without a doubt.
On the other hand, Manning, though he rarely runs the ball, is one of the league's all-time great quarterbacks and has the experience of having played in three Super Bowls, winning one in 2007 when he was with the Indianapolis Colts. He is the NFL's all-time leader in career touchdown passes and passing yards, and Newton has high praise for his opponent.
There's a lot of things that Peyton has done, is doing, that I wish I could mimic, but I can't. You know, do it like Peyton can. It's only, you know, he can do it. But I try to translate not only things I learned from him or have, you know, saw him do, but, you know, other quarterbacks in this league, and I try to apply it to my own.
It all adds up to what fans hope will be a great NFL championship for the Super Bowl's golden anniversary. Carolina is about a 6-point favorite to beat Denver. Park Brewer, VOA News, San Francisco.
Yes, it's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and it's the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent. Yeah, I want to low, I want to lala, I want to lala. I want to low, I want to lala, I want to lala.
Now we know baby matter daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now we don't talk to butter. Family they smile and we know the quanta. That we just say Yoruba, make them no go forget say Madonna Baba.
Morocco, Liberia, and Ghana, South Africa. On the beat, oh no, yeah, must hear. Say Cardo on this one, yeah. When me you de, when just no dey to mix my gin, oh. When me you de, when girls no grito dance my disco, oh. When me you de, when nappa no grito shine the lights, oh. When me you de, when man no sleep day walk all night. Don't jazzy sign, small boy turn the biggie man. My boy bye to my mouse. So my boy drive the kicker. Bless you follow this my boy, oh. When me you, yes when me you. Down in the gutter back then when me you, yeah. When me you, when no BMW. Now I'm Mr. Cafe Bule, Banky W, yeah. I be at them coma. Now my life you not get coma. I be at them coma. Challenge me, I don't believe my power, yeah. Oluwani, you don't see Oluwani. Oluwani, shebi you don't see Oluwani. Oluwani, shebi tiri Oluwani. Oluwani, shebi you don't see Oluwani. When me you de, when juice no de to mix my gin, oh. When me you de, when girls no grito dance my disco, oh. When me you de, when nappa no grito shine the lights, oh. When me you de, when man no sleep day walk all night. Make them. All of my guys and my girls, everybody done make them. Shabby now God, they bless them. Shabby now God, Baba God, now him just they bless them. All of my guys, they relate. All of the guys, where they hate, all of them, they relate though. All of the girls, them run over here. All of the girls, them run over here, yeah. Oluwani, you don't see Oluwani. Oluwani, Shabby, you don't see Oluwani. Oluwani, Shabby, see the Oluwani. Shebi, you don't see Oluwani. When me you de, when juice no de to mix my gin, oh. When me you de, when girls no grito dance my disco, oh. When me you de, when nappa no grito shine the lights, oh. When me you de, when man no sleep day walk all night, oh. It's my boy. It's my boy turn to biggie man. My boy bye to my mouse. So my boy drive the kicker. Bless you follow this my boy, oh.
Oh yes, how about that? Hope you enjoyed that music. And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here is Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week,
President Buhari of Nigeria made some pertinent remarks about Libya that should have been made earlier by the African Union or other African heads of state. He observed that the chaotic developments in Libya would have serious repercussions not only in Europe, but for the rest of the African continent. It would appear that the African Union is hesitant to re-enter the Libyan fray for the fact that it was earlier rebuffed when it tried to do so. You may recall that at the start of the Benghazi uprising against Colonel Gaddafi, the African Union prepared a well-thought-out roadmap aimed at reconciliation between Colonel Gaddafi and his opposition. But those powers that had other interests, that is, to execute regime change in the context of the so-called Arab Spring, maneuvered that the Libyan opposition and other states reject the African roadmap. The argument then was that the African Union was too indebted to Colonel Gaddafi and would not be neutral. What was being said, in fact, was that the roadmap did not call for the removal of Colonel Gaddafi. We now also know that once the roadmap was sidelined, maneuvers were put in motion for the Gulf Cooperation Council and the League of Arab States to prepare a so-called no-fly zone. That resolution was tabled in the Security Council and was adopted. We also know that the resolution on no-fly zone became the vehicle for the overthrow and death of Colonel Gaddafi. What was regrettable in terms of the African members then in the Security Council, the three African members, is that they voted in favor of the no-fly zone, even though they know how the African plan was rebuffed. And they also voted in favor when states like India, Brazil, China, Germany, Soviet Union were all abstaining. And the rest is history. Now we see a situation, as we have seen in Iraq and Syria, but where you have chaos, which still reigns in Libya following the overthrow of Gaddafi, ISIL or Daesh would find a way to exploit it. And there have been recent reports that ISIL has now made a push in Libya, and it has also maintained some full control in Sirte. Now, we may remember that Sirte is the birthplace of Colonel Gaddafi. It was also the place that Colonel Gaddafi developed as the future headquarters of the African Union if his plan for strengthening union has been adopted. We also know that the first repercussion for the overthrow of Gaddafi was the repercussion in places like Mali. And Mali is still suffering from that consequence of the overthrow of Gaddafi. Now imagine what would happen if Sirte became the major base of ISIL, and ISIL is able to liaise with the terrorist group of Boko Haram in Nigeria, which is already causing havoc not only in Nigeria, but in neighboring states like Cameroon and Chad. And imagine later on to see further east, in the Horn of Africa, where Al-Shabaab is demonstrating that it's not yet on its knees. And also the fact that just last week, with the explosion of an aircraft in Mogadishu, it is now being said that Al-Shabaab may have developed the capacity for downing aircraft. So General Buhari, the Nigerian leader, was right to call attention to the repercussion if the chaos continues in Libya. It is now time for the African Union to request that it should be consulted on what happens in Libya. Not only those who are in the Mediterranean or in Europe, but Africa has an interest in seeing the normalization in Libya. And we should remember what a great African leader, the former president of Egypt, Colonel Nasser, during the 1956 crisis, he said, and I quote, "Those who begin a war never know how it will end." I thank you.
Thank you. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Please join us again next Saturday. Have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria James Entwistle was present at the Memorandum of Understanding signing ceremony in Kaduna, Nigeria in late January for routine immunization in Borno, Kaduna, Sokoto, and Bauchi states. I am proud that the U.S. government is joining the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Dangote Foundation in the strong pursuit to end vaccine-preventable child deaths in Nigeria, said Ambassador Entwistle. Under this partnership, we are helping Sokoto State to increase and sustain high immunization coverage. This occasion demonstrates the willingness and commitment of your governments and organizations to tackle the challenges to achieving these goals. The United States provides significant resources, more than $500 million annually, for programs to address serious health issues, such as child mortality, maternal and newborn health, HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. These MOUs offer the model platform to capitalize on the prospects of evidence-based approaches, said Ambassador Entwistle. Results will include stronger systems for immunizations, equal access to routine immunization services, and building capacity for Nigerian states like Sokoto to lead in developing solutions for its people. Perhaps even more importantly, these agreements serve as a model on which to base future partnerships between development partners and the government of Nigeria. Ensuring transparency and accountability in the implementation of this program demonstrates the pledge of the governments of all the states involved to ensuring they meet their responsibilities to their constituents. Essential health services, like routine immunization programs, can only be provided when all partners are coordinated and committed in this manner. Immunization represents one of the most cost-effective public health interventions. Routine immunization services, when sustained, reduce maternal and child illnesses and deaths and free up other resources for economic development. Under this partnership, the U.S. government will maintain its focus on Sokoto State, offering quality technical assistance in support of the partners' harmonized work plan in that state. Our ultimate goal, said Ambassador Entwistle, is to end preventable child and maternal deaths and to achieve an AIDS-free generation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.